Hello and welcome to the 97th episode of the Machine Ethics Podcast. This time we're chatting with Enrico Pane. This was recorded on the 13th of January 2025. We chat about elements of the digital revolution, the importance of knowing tech as a tech philosopher. We talk about what it means to be an ethicist and that ethicists should diagnose but not judge. We also talk about the idea of ethics being a burden in corporations, but maybe in reality that ethics can make you run faster without breaking things. We also talk about quality and pasta, as well as finding a new marks for this digital world. If you like this episode, you can find more at machine-ethics.net. You can contact us, hello@machine-ethics.net. You can find us on Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube @machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine-ethics. Thanks very much and I hope you enjoy. Hope you're well. Welcome to the podcast. I'm just warming up, obviously. We are really happy to have you on the show. Could you introduce yourself, who you are and what do you do?
Hi, Ben. Thanks for inviting me. I'm an AI ethicist. That means that I'm generally giving advices to companies on their AI ethics strategies and what kind of tools they have to use or what kind of standards they have to comply with, this kind of stuff.
And you're currently based in France, is that right?
Yes, I'm an European guy. I'm Italian, living in France.
Yeah. And at the head of the show, we always ask quite a simple question, which always has different answers, which I enjoy. So to you, Enrico, what is AI?
Yes, it's a simple question, but a quite complex one. I think there are many different ways to approach this question. At the moment, AI is a good label for the market. It's more marketable than other titles, and I admit I've done the same on a small scale. However, if we stick to the common definition of AI, we refer to all those set of technologies that attempt to solve problems like or similarly to a human being. But somebody mistakenly think that artificial intelligence, because there is a word intelligence, it's related to the brain and we want to duplicate the brain in an artificial way. In reality, it's more related to the functionality that we can have with this kind of technology. So basically, you have the classical distinction from logical AI to data-driven AI, or the methods that they are used for creating AI, or finally, for the kind of functional use you have with it, that means classification or creation. So I would say that AI is the normal evolution of the digital revolution. That means that we had a big revolution, the digital, that is still misunderstood, I think, and from the many. And we have AI that is the only possible way to treat in a sensible manner all the big amount of data that we are producing every day to help us to treat those data.
I feel like there's a load of information in there. What do you think is misunderstood about the digital revolution or the digital informational revolution in that kind of trajectory?
That's the very nature of this kind of revolution. There is no other revolution like the digital that had an impact on the world. Maybe the writing. The writing is a technology. We generally forget it, but writing is not something natural. It's a technology that human being has used to collect information, to transmit information, and to save information. Now, the digital is at the same level, and it changed completely the world. The bad point is that we are still the majority of time using the physical paradigms to treat the digital. A simple example is, for example, when you make or have an invoice from a company, this is thought on a A4 paper, so on a physical paper, but in reality, if you reason like somebody from the digital, it should be understood as a connection of data, so a small database and several records, and we shouldn't have the need to have a printed version of an invoice, but we still are so attached of the printed part that we are creating software to print it, and then other software to scan it and reinterpret what was already digital. So we are missing something.
Yeah, you're kind of like making this digital physical back to digital thing. I don't know if you. I mean, some listeners will remember the fax machine. I don't know if you remember the fax machine. That you had this like physical paper that goes through. They digitize it to go to through the phone lines, and then it comes back out the fax machine the other end. And it feels a bit like that. And I remember when I first got a fax via email, and it was like, we've mixed metaphors too much here, guys. So in that way, you think we are still kind of grappling with being more digital in the digital way and more physical in the physical way, and having maybe that these things haven't kind of got together in the way that the iconography or the way that we interact with them, the human interface with them, isn't quite juvenile still.
It's not yet very well understood. But if you think of the time we started to democratize the digital, it started in the 90s, because before only specialists would use the computer. But in the 90s, we started to democratize it. Mm. And I still remember at the end of the 90s, helping friends to create their first email. So, and it's not so far for a revolution so big. Just to make an example, if you think that the writing is generally supposed to be 2000 years before Jesus Christ, and before democratizing it, we arrived at the last century where the schools were created, a lot of people started to read. Mm. It took a lot of time. So in only 30 years, we wanted to understand a revolution that is deeply changing our way of thinking, organizing, etc. And we are still in a thinking in an industrial revolution, but working and living in a digital revolution.
Right. And do you think, coming back to your day job and stuff, do you think that the AI part of that is part of that informational revolution, the digital revolution, or is that kind of a sea change? Again,
absolutely. No, I think that this is completely in the digital revolution. So basically, what AI is for is to transform data into information. Okay, before we used software to do it that were deterministic with the logic that we decided, but always to transform data to information. AI is taking a lot of data, creating models just to have new information that makes sense to what we have to do. And this is the big difference, because in the past, in the physical world, information were never separated by the data or the support. Okay, you couldn't see in a poetry or in any kind of old document data. You always see so information. And this differentiation is harder to understand what data are and what information is. I use just to have an example that just show how important it is. We were trained to do addition using the positional the position of number so that at school, in primary school, we know what column we should add to make an addition. Now, the positional system of number is so embedded in our thinking that when we are doing an Excel table, we ask the sum at the end of the table, because our thinking is related to the physical way of thinking. In reality, if you think in an informational way, data should be completely separate by the total. So it should be total should be in another sheet, not in even in the same, because those are information, and information are used to make a decision, okay, to make a choice, and data general are used to collect some kind of basic and atomic information that then we can re-elaborate. So in everyday life, we are still a connection with the physical world that we use to cope with. And even new generation have exactly the same connection.
And so so you're making this distinction between data and information. And it seems to me that people are using these technologies to do exactly what you said, like transform data into information or into actionable information, things that we can then do something with. You know, we've got hundreds of thousands of pictures of dogs, and now we can make assumptions about the fact that this new picture is a dog or whatever. It turns data into action almost. But then you start getting things which generate more data almost, or not, you know, you know, it's going in all different directions. Do you see that there are kind of less useful ways of using the technology in that way, or that people are maybe spending more time in certain directions when the tooling could just be used like this over here?
Yes, the point of... I think that the answer for it is how we design the technologies we are using at the moment. So whenever a technology is needed to treat a technology, there is a problem in the design at the base. It's like, I try to hypersimplify, it's like if we are creating a technology to click on a button, okay? There is something missing about it. Okay, yeah. And we are doing that. We are doing exactly that. We are fed up of clicking on buttons. We are creating technologies to do it. And the example of the invoices, I did it before. It's exactly that. Anytime I'm traveling, going to the restaurant, I have a ticket. I have to make the ticket that was produced by a digital machine that was printed. So it became analogical. Then I take my mobile, I take a picture, and an AI system is going to read what it was already digital. So we are wasting time. And this is just because we didn't create the right bridge to have this kind of information. And paradoxically, or today, we have a public administration or university that are asking for printed tickets. And they do not trust the information. The real information is the record on my bank account. Yeah. The other one can be fake, created by AI. I can use even classical graphic to remake it. So everything else is fake. And still, we believe more the something that is possibly fake than the real information that is recorded in an official database.
That's really interesting. It really rings with me, because I feel like a lot of the time people are using, I guess, just digital tools, but also AI in places where it's a system problem. It's like, well, you just need to change the way it works, and then, you know, most of what you've just done there will go away, and we can just then make this like new functionality on top. It'd be great. I need to think of some like good analogies for that maybe. So I was hoping that we could come back to what your day job is. And you say you're an AI ethicist, and I was wondering, just before we get to that, what brought you to the interest in philosophy and then the philosophy of technology in the start?
So I finished my my high school, and I chose my university, and I don't know why, but the natural choice for me was philosophy at the time, and maybe because I had a wonderful professor that helped me to make this choice. But at the same time, I was a small geek. In my generation, we started with home computing, and I had my first algorithms book when I was 10, and it was really interesting, and I felt really natural to move from natural languages to formal languages. So when I was studying at university, I found that AI was... the digital in general was the real world that was going to arrive. Now, in my faculty, I was the only one to do that. So I was obliged to go around in other faculties to study IT, databases, networks, you name it. I had to fight with my professor sometimes to make them accept that I was doing exams that were not related to philosophy. But what I felt at the time is that that philosopher had to know IT to cope with the news phenomenon, because I don't like to talk about something without knowing it. So I studied a lot of IT at the time. And in my final work, was dedicated to the alienation of human rights in communicative communications. Where I already talked about the AI, I had also the opportunity to have another professor, a mathematician, that was also a friend that was working on AI at the time. So I'm talking about the 90s. And so I had already very clear the difference between the model-driven AI and the data-driven AI, and how it could impact society in the future. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't my job for a year, because as I generally say, companies weren't ready to pay an ethicist of the digital. They became ready with the new summer of AI. And that's because AI raised a big problem, and the problem of the allocation of the responsibility that before was easy to do. You are a developer, you are responsible for the software you are developing. It's as simple as that. We have AI system that have a capability to act, so an agency. And so it's more difficult to say an AI system is responsible. We do not accept it, because in our human form, we like to punish responsible people or to praise responsible people for what they are doing. So it's difficult to accept morally that a machine is doing something for us, and we cannot give it the blame of what is doing. So ethics raised again 10 years ago, more or less, and they started to pay ethicists to do their job. And I would say that before my profession became really that one of AI ethicists, before I was working as a ICT consultant more than AI ethics. So I was doing ethics anyway, digital ethics, because I was designing software with my ethical background, but I wasn't paid for doing it. Yeah. And then I became paid, and there are still people who are doing that, but doing academics to have a kind of sustainability in their job. So I think that the path is still to arrive to have a real profession that is sustainable.
Mm. And do you think that we'll get to a point where that sort of area, or AI ethicist, or ethicist of technology, or whatever you want to call it, is more professionalized. You know, you have some sort of stamp of approval, or qualification, or society or standard that everyone's agreed that that's what we're doing now, guys.
Yeah. Yes, and this is because when I started to use my title as AI ethicist, and again, if I should use a very philosophical approach, I would call myself informational ethicist, but or digital ethicist, but it's more sellable, more marketable AI ethics. Yeah. So,
when did you start calling yourself an AI ethicist, out of interest?
Oh, I think 6 years ago, or something like that. Yeah. But before, I was an informational ethicist, or more related to all the philosophy of information field. And yes, when I started, I had already a background in consulting and advisory, and I realized that in the field, as always arrive, you had a lot of people that were just choosing to call themselves AI ethicists. And it was good for in some way for AI ethics, because it shows that we needed something about AI ethics. But at the same time, companies couldn't recognize who were the professional AI ethicists from the activists. Very important for society. I think that activists and are important to advise companies outside the company. But AI ethicists are more than that. And so I started with some colleagues to think about it. And we started to build a kind of strategy to say, we have this opportunity to be AI ethicists. We must be humble enough and rigid enough against ourselves to create a profession that is recognized by companies and public administration. Because the majority of companies told me at the beginning, we are afraid to employ AI ethicists because they are going to judge us. They are going so they saw them as moralists, you know?
Yeah.
And in reality, we are more, I like more the analogy of psychologists. You are a psychologist, you are talking with a patient, but you are not telling outside the room what are the problem of the patient. Mm. Your aim is not to be visible from the world, but to help the patient. And this is what we are doing, and it's very hard. Mm. And so we have to understand what is our role in the industry, or in the academy, on in the public administration.
Yeah. I think that's a really nice way of phrasing it as well. I think we need t-shirts or something that says that, you know, we're here to help company patients succeed or whatever as AI ethicist people. So when you go into these companies, public companies, private companies, do you find it that they have this specific remit now, or that? And what I was discussing in the last previous couple of episodes is that maybe some of that remit is changing, because I feel like we had maybe 10 years of things getting made by people, and now we're having companies procure AI. Basically, we've got this massive shift between creating machine learning products and services to having these AI tools and using them in all sorts of places. So I don't know how you feel about that, and if your work is changing because of that in the last year or so.
It depends on the company you are working with, first of all. I have a personal strategy, but everybody can have a different one. When I started to be paid to be an AI ethicist, I realized that the majority of companies put together ethics and compliance. Okay. And so they were saying, we are ethical because we are compliant. And this is not exactly the same. We must be compliant to the law, to standards, and we may still be ethically unacceptable in what we are doing. So there is a big difference between the two of them. So because I like to know when I talk to people what I'm talking about, I started to do standards and to make standards and to participate in standard organizations. So at the moment, I'm in the European body for standardization, SENSENELEC, and I'm leading a group that is developing standards, for example, for the EU AI Act or for sustainable AI, for the competence of developers, so different societal and fundamental aspects of AI. And I'm doing exactly the same at international level in ISO. I learned how standards work. So now I can talk to people that do compliance and say, okay, you are compliant, you are not still doing some ethically acceptable. And why that? Because paradoxically, you have ethics in adjectives and adverbs. What it means that it takes the EU AI Act, very famous in Europe and around the world at the moment. You have adjectives as acceptable, sufficient, preferable. How do you treat those adjectives? You can do only with a moral or ethical approach. So you have to create a board of competent people that will assess what is the threshold of acceptability. You cannot have a number for that, or at least you will never have a universal number for that. Anytime you try to fix a universal number, you risk to make a big mistake on it. So we have ethics in every interpretation of those rules. So I generally used to quote a PhD student of mine, because I work with several PhD students in my company, and he paraphrases a phrase of Kant, and he says, ethicists without procedures are blind. But procedures, and we have a lot of procedures at the moment, guidelines, and you name it, but it's quite common. But procedures without ethicists are mere intellectual play. And this is what is important to know. Yes, you can say what should be transparent, but if you do not have people that understand what transparency is at this different level of abstractions, then you are just doing ethical washing, because not trusting you are doing anything good.
Right. And that's part of parcel what you were saying earlier about having the buyer's remorse for companies, almost having, you know, the difficulty of having lots of players in this space pop up over the last, you know, 6 years, and say that the AI ethicists or be interested in the space of AI ethics, or the ethics of technology or ethics of information, and then having them deliver wildly different things, right? And hope that, you know, some of those things might have been okay for companies, and some of those things are just like, you know, we had an interesting time and we delivered nothing useful, basically. But so you're trying to like put together those standards and interact with all the different policies coming in, so that you can be compliant and also take compliance to this higher echelon almost, and be confident that you're both compliant, but also you're standing on the right side of what that compliance means in the future. I feel like it's almost like the goalposts will keep changing, and we need to make sure that we are ahead of the goalpost almost.
Yeah.
And especially with technology, because it keeps changing, you know, you're creating the future, and you need to be ahead of what is acceptable in the future, because otherwise, or knowledgeable about what might come, because otherwise you're going to shoot yourself in the foot. I just rambled at you there.
It's exactly what you just expressed, and I would add that in my negative judgment of the people who is coming in the profession is not that they cannot be trained to become AI ethicists. I think that we have to build the profession. We need people coming from the IT, from the legal aspect, from philosophy. It's also true that, as somebody said, doing ethics without philosophy is doing physics without mathematics. So, and the risk is to be commonsensical. And common sense, or the grandmother recipe, it's very good, but it's not scientific. So sometimes you can have counterintuitive answers from an ethicist that you haven't thought about. There is another point that I like generally to emphasize, is that ethicists are not giving a moral judgment. And I say that because in a lot of conference, people arrive to me with an example and a use case, and they ask me, is it good or bad?
Yeah.
Okay. And I say, okay, guy, I'm not God. I'm Enrico Panay. I'm exactly the same moral value than anybody else in the world. It's not because I studied philosophy that my judgment is better than other. And even more, in my profession, I avoid to give judgment because they will put me in a very sensible situation. It means that I will have a conflict of interest. If I make a moral judgment, I will defend my moral judgment. So I will stop listening for everybody else. What I have to do is to create the environment where the company can arrive to take a moral decision with the right information, with a good rationale, avoiding to have any internal conflict of interest. This is my process, not giving a judgment. So the point is that unlike what people can think, we are not judging. And when we are judging, we value exactly as everybody else. And I'm telling them to philosophers, okay, to ethicists, we are not better than others in judging. At the same time, we need to, in some way, be humble enough to understand that that we need other observation to arrive to a good solution for a company. So this is the big process we have to do when we are working with companies and helping them to make a judgment.
And I'm interested in your organization. Do you work with other people? Is it just you, or is it the you work together with universities, or how does that work?
Yes, I do work with some university. I'm teaching and doing research for two reasons. Doing research is fundamental in our field because you have so many new approaches that are just coming up every day that it's interesting to be updated. And teaching is quite interesting because it obliges you to consolidate your practical knowledge for an audience, and so you have to explain it. So these are the double effect to make your knowledge consolidated, to make it easy to understand for people, and then you can reuse it when you are going to sell your knowledge to companies. So it's a practical approach. So yes, I'm working with a university for that. And in my personal business model, I'm working with, as I said, industrial PhD candidates. And I until now I had a wonderful experience with them, wonderful people, and people who doesn't want to become a researcher or a professor at university, very realistic people, but at the same time they would like to have a higher level of competences. So we are working and I'm trying to push them to take the responsibilities, to meet people around the world, to do conferences or publish papers. And I have until now I had the opportunity to have really great people around me who are helping me every day, and they are getting wonderful offers. So, for example, a few of them had to stop the industrial PhD, still carry on the PhD, and I'm helping them in the PhD, but not in the industrial part, because they had wonderful offers from consulting companies, and I'm so glad for that and for them that the work we did together could produce this result.
Awesome. Great. So you do research and you write papers and you write, you're an author. This is the pithy comment, isn't it? Is it required to make pasta while you're explaining ethics?
That's a wonderful one. Yes, I published in Italian and French a book, and it's explaining AI ethics to my son. And I didn't want to do an essay, so I did want to make a dialogue. In the very philosophical culture, it's not something new. We lost a bit this capacity during the last centuries, but in the past was quite common to have dialogues. Plato used to write dialogues, but mine is far away from him. It's just a bit. A small exercise where I'm talking with my son while we are cooking pasta. Now, as you can maybe guess from my accent, I am an Italian guy, and this has got a big impact in my axiological approach, just to use a difficult word, but in the values that that shape my decision process. So why pasta is important? Let's start from another point of view. If you try to offend the Pope in Italy, then we'll accept it. Better than you are trying to add some cream in a pasta alla carbonara, then we'll have a real crisis. So
I think I've done that in the past. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
You can redeem yourself. And this is it's quite unacceptable for Italian. Yes, we are quite strict about food, but this is quite interesting for different. So I'm a big fan of a philosopher that still not considered a philosopher from the official academicians, and it's Robert Pirsig. Robert Pirsig wrote two books, and I'm in the book I wrote, I was inspired by him. The first is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, that is the most famous. And the second one is Lila, that is less famous, but quite interesting. Now, his research was about quality in all his life, moral quality, metaphysical quality, and he did a wonderful research about it. He wrote not some essay, but some trips while I was cooking with my son, he was traveling with his son in the first book, and he's wrote about quality. Now, why I'm talking about it? Because there is a connection between quality and pasta in Italy. I just quote the most difficult dish we generally do with pasta in Italy is a dish called cacio e pepe, and it's basically cheese and pepper. You say, you have not a lot of ingredient. You have water, salt in the water to cook the pasta, and then you have cheese, a particular cheese, and pepper. And still, it's considered one of the most difficult dishes to prepare. So it means that you can reach quality with a few elements, but that are perfectly balanced. And when it comes to ethics in my daily work, I take more or less the same approach. A few well-balanced ingredients, it might sound easy, but you arrive to do something using in the background a very complex knowledge to balance those ingredients. And I think that we should do ethics using some elements in a good way, not just a lot of elements at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm interested, was it a fiction dialogue, or did you actually talk to your son about as you go?
Yeah, the starting point was a real life question. So, when he was 17, he one day he just asked me, "Hey, Dad, I don't know how to explain my friends what you are doing." Yeah. And so I started to explain to him what I was doing, and it started with a few evening discussing about it. Then I transformed it in something that we generally do together. We cook together, we are passionate about it, and so we tried to make it a dialogue around it with another characters that came from Persig. That is the uncle Phaedrus. That is a character used by Persing in the books he wrote. Maybe one thing about how ethics is perceived at the moment.
Mm. Yep.
By companies, because we had business ethics in the past. It was generally more related to the legal aspects than the philosophical one. Mm-hmm. And today we have AI ethics, and in the future maybe we'll have more kind of ethics related to the digital that will rise. Yeah. And generally ethics is felt by companies as a burden. You know, yep. We have the ethical guy, okay, cost, and is slowing down our innovation and our process. Mm. This is how it is felt. But because I had a long experience in designing software, I think that ethics is something different. Mm-hmm. And I like to use an example. We had in Italy a champion in archery. It was Marco Galeazzo. He won several medals. And in an interview, sometimes in a few years ago, he said, sometimes you need a psychologist more than a trainer. Okay? This statement surprised me at the beginning, but it makes sense because precision is achieved through calmness. So they needed to have psychological meetings to arrive to the right calmness to be more precise. Mm. And then I like to see ethics in the same way, as a discipline that helps company to stay on target. When it comes to AI, the complexity is very important.
Yeah.
And so an ethicist must possess a blend of different knowledges from technical, legal, ethical skills. But what he must aim to do is to make the company run faster and still be ethical. Anytime we are slowing down the companies, we are maybe not using all our ethical knowledge in the right way. So I think I will love CEOs or project managers to understand that, okay, you have a good prepared ethicist in the room, and then you'll do better your job, and you'll earn also more. It's just not a cost ethics. It's something that can help companies. That's why we create an association to put together prepared and professional ethicists. It's the Association of AI Ethicists, where we are trying to push the right competence for them.
Yeah, and I think that's something that several people have repeated, like Olivia and I think Alice as well, who are that, you know, they just say ethics is part of innovation. You know, when you're doing innovation, you can do it ethically, you know, using ethics as innovation, basically. That's what they would say, which chimes a bit with your kind of, it helps you to move faster and to understand basically better where you're going.
But by the way, just a point about it. Ethics is not something that you are adding somewhere. It's like language. It's there. Any time you take a decision, you have an ethical approach. The point is that your ethical approach is not explicit. It's implicit. So you are, when I wrote in the past a code, I choose a library or I choose to collect some kind of data, I was making decisions that had an ethical impact. The point is to be aware of that ethical impact. Mm-hmm. And if you are aware, is there you are creating innovation. It's so it's not something to add. It's not like salt. It's it's like language. It's there. You are using it.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Enrico. So my final question, which might lead us somewhere else, is what scares you about our AI-mediated future, and what is exciting you at the moment? And I'm interested in, you know, what you're looking forward to in 2025 and things.
Okay. I don't know. I have more the approach of a sailor. I try to adapt to the winds. Honestly, I fear misuses of AI, even at the political level, because we are seeing reading news nowadays. So a bad use of AI can be very dangerous. But what I also am afraid of is the overuse of AI, using that where it's not important. Is not necessary. And I've been talking with a lot of developers saying, okay, I went through my process to use AI to do something, then I came back to use some other kind of approach and they were even better. So it's not always, it's not because it's more sellable that you have to use AI, okay? The marketer should stop to put AI everywhere if a better system is using classical software. And then at the same time, the underuse of AI. We are afraid of AI, so we will not use it. Okay, those are my two main fear. There is something I'd like to reduce all the principles. So you have some very metaphysical principle about AI in the philosophy of information, about the entropy that should be reduced or avoided in the digital world. And then you have some characteristics that are related to AI, and everybody is citing some proxy characteristics to say that a system should be ethical, like transparency, human oversight, and robustness, accuracy. You know them. They are always the same. I will take just one principle, only one. And the principle is that any process or AI system or even old software that you are going to put into the market or we have to develop should never, ever steal even a single second of someone's life. So this is only my principle. Mm. If you arrive to put a new system that is not asking me to spend my time, this is good design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
Thank you.
Drop the mic. I think that's, for me, it's like companies are in this very precarious situation where they want to do good because they want to make a good product, you know, stuff like this. And they want people to buy it. But they can go too far the other way and be like, well, we can create the environment where people want our product and create the environment where people are unable to buy other people's products and create the environment. You know what I mean? So they can use they can exert their power to create wealth or create power for themselves over actual the needs or the wants or the requirements of society. So I think it's weird because sometimes you have this really different situation when you're working with public sector or you're working with research bodies and stuff like that, where it's like their requirement to do that is like diminished. Like, so their implicit, you know, values in that system are really different to what I see in private sector. So I don't know if that's a much simplified version of what's going on, but I think capitalism has a lot to say for what we're doing at the moment and how we're treating technology. I think a lot of the stuff that we talk about in AI ethics would probably disappear if the incentive structures were different, but that might be a different conversation.
Yeah, but it's a good point what you are raising, because with the Industrial Revolution, we had new philosophical and political structure that we had to develop to cope with that revolution. Mm-hmm. We haven't developed the right structure to cope with the digital from a political point of view. So yes, there is this gap. Mm-hmm. I can say we may be missing a marks of the digital. Okay, let's say like that. Not just to have the communist approach, but in a different economical approach to what we are doing. And I think that a few years ago I used to say that we are still making contracts with people that are saying that people should work 8 hours per day, okay? And this is something that is completely related to the industrial world. And people saying, I remember a former president candidate that was president also in France. He used to say, that we have to work more to earn more. This is an industrial approach, because if I work better, faster, I should be paid more. So the idea is that we should shift our way of thinking, but we are far away from it. So that's why, for example, with my collaborators, we are working a lot, but there is no time. It means that we are trying to reduce all the possible activity to what is really necessary. Okay. It's sometimes we work a lot because sadly enough, we have a lot of demand for our company at the moment, and I would like to have more time to do other stuff. So yes, we have to try to do new incentives to that.
That's nice. I think that rhymes. It sounds like the cultural vision of what we were sold, like, you know, less work, more play, more leisure time, better work. Is that's, you know, that would be ideal, right? In where we want to get to.
Yes. It is related to my biblical, very religious principle of not wasting time of people.
Right. Yeah. 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 Is that your main value?
It's always been my main value from the very beginning. When I developed the software, it was to improve the life of people. Mm. And now you were talking about markets, but yep. You go in a university today and you have a stratification of different software and you talk to everybody, say we are spending a lot of time filling forms and doing stuff that is not our work. The work of professor is teaching and doing research, not demonstrating that he's teaching and doing research. And you spend more time on demonstrating than in doing. So there is still a big problem around it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And with that last thing, I don't want to take up any more of your time. Thank you very much for coming on the show. How do people find you, follow you, all that sort of thing?
So on LinkedIn, I'm very bad of I try to communicate what we are doing, but I'm very bad on doing it. So I generally publish something on LinkedIn, but just get in contact with me and it's better. And by the way, thank you. You have a very kind approach on the subject and easy one. And I like your way of asking questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks very much. And I will speak to you again.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Hello, and welcome to the end of the show. Thanks again for Enrico for coming on the show and talking about his work and pasta. I'm also particularly keen to find a marks for the digital world. I think that's something that we should endeavour to imagine, create a broader set of ideas that we could move towards. I'm having a bit of a crisis in terms of social media at the moment. There seems to be this mass exodus from X or Twitter, so I'm just wondering, is that the case for you? I personally have a Blue Sky account for me as Ben Byford. I was wondering if it would be useful for a Machine Ethics Blue Sky account, and whether I should be talking about our LinkedIn account, as we do post on LinkedIn as well. So if you could let us know if you have an opinion, where do you find out about things, how do you interact, comment on things these days, that'd be really, really useful to know and help me out. So thank you very much. Again, if you want to help the podcast, you can tell your friends and you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machineethics. And if you can, you can leave a comment or leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, and I'll speak to you soon.